bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Pakistan has joined the rest of the Muslim world to condemn the Indian ruling party. Two senior officials of the Bharatiya Janata Party recently made derogatory remarks that disrespect the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. The Indian envoy in Islamabad was summoned by the Foreign Office to record a strong protest. In a statement, Pakistan says the remarks have not only deeply hurt the sentiments of the people of Pakistan, but billions of Muslims around the world.
People in Pakistan are outraged by the insulting remarks. They are demanding strong action against those Indian officials, as well as calling on the Muslim world to put up a united front against this religious bigotry.
After uproar in the Muslim world, the Indian ruling party suspended its two officials, but people feel that is not enough.
This is a test for the OIC. The OIC has issued a statement, but it is not enough. This OIC must take a stand and raise this issue with Mr. Modi.
We condemn
this. Such sentiments against our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, hurts the religious sentiments of Muslims.
Pakistan's leading religious clerics have also condemned the insulting remarks.
All religious schools of thoughts in Pakistan have unanimously condemned what happened in India. We will work together and evolve a joint strategy against this incident.
The controversy has strained India's relationship with the Muslim world. Experts believe Indian ties could further deteriorate with the Muslim world if its leadership does not extend a public apology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Families of Palestinian prisoners and rights activists have held a sit-in protest inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of some 5,000 political prisoners held in Israeli jails. Their solidarity action comes as some 450 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for the military court hearings for more than 6 months. These detainees are held in Israeli jails without charge or trial for a long time. Their only recourse to call attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food for more than 3 months, and Raed Rayyan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since more than 2 months ago.
We are talking about the Palestinian administrative detainees who are boycotting the Israeli military court since the beginning of this year to demanding to stop the administrative detention. And nowadays, two Palestinian detainees are ongoing on their hunger strike.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers, where rights groups say they are denied their basic human rights.
Palestinian prisoners are being held under inhumane conditions inside Israeli jails.
Israel refuses to respect the international conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners. We will continue our solidarity and our resistance until all our prisoners are free.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
Medical negligence, which is targeting hundreds of Palestinian sick prisoners, this procedures, we always talk about it, and we demand the international community to interfere and to stop such policies, and also the invasions, the daily invasions to the sections and prisons of Palestinian detainees.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Rights groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The moment of truth for the embattled British Prime Minister at the end of a day rife with speculation about his political survival.
Good evening. I can report as returning officer that 359 ballots were cast, no spoiled ballots, that the vote in favour of having confidence in Boris Johnson as leader was 211 votes. And a vote against was 148 votes.
It's a result that means Boris Johnson is now a weakened leader and with an uncertain future, although he himself doesn't think so.
Well, I think this is a very good result for politics and for the country.
Just in, it's just
I do. Just in this sense, I think it's a convincing result, a decisive result, and what it means is that as a government, we can move on and focus on the stuff that I think really matters.
But it's exactly this stuff that matters to people that forced members of his own Conservative Party to call for a no-confidence vote. Lockdown law-breaking parties held at government buildings at the height of the pandemic, when families were banned from visiting even dying relatives.
This vote was inevitable. We all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of getting the Jubilee out of the way. Why? Because the Conservative Party is really nervous about losing the next election. Let's not pretend this is about high principle. Boris Johnson was elected as an electoral asset. Now he's an electoral liability, and he's going to stay that way as far as I can see.
The sticky Partygate scandal played a major role in Conservative MPs challenging Johnson's position, but it was not the only reason.
It's about the end of party time in so many different areas. His green agenda is nothing to do with Conservative policy and is, in my view, directly responsible for the cost of living crisis. He's apparently failed to deliver on the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is essential to a unionist party, a party that doesn't want to see the breakup of the United Kingdom. And then there are small gaffes, times when he just doesn't look like he's taking the job seriously.
Things came to a boiling point over the weekend when the Prime Minister was booed at an event celebrating the Queen's 70-year rule. And prior to Monday's vote, allegations of intimidation and arm twisting by number 10 trying to get Conservative MPs to change their minds. And the last-ditch effort by Boris Johnson himself writing to MPs begging for a second chance.
So Boris Johnson managed to survive this vote on his premiership, but by a number that will continue to be an open wound for the members of his Conservative Party, which is why some experts say he won't be able to hold on to power for much longer. Saeed Pour is up, London.
The U.S. and South Korea launched 8 surface-to-surface ballistic missiles off South Korea's east coast early Monday morning. These follow North Korea's test firing of 8 missiles a day earlier. During a Memorial Day ceremony, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol reiterated his firm policy against Pyongyang.
Our government will deal sternly with any provocations from North Korea. While deterring North Korea's nuclear and missile threats, we will pursue fundamental and practical security capabilities.
North Korea has conducted more than a dozen missile tests this year. Still, Pyongyang lags far behind Seoul in conventional arms and the overall arsenal at its disposal. The U.S. stations 28,500 troops equipped with various advanced weapons in South Korea. It's that imbalance that some analysts believe motivates North Korea to continue missile and nuclear arms development.
North Korea attaches great importance to the balance of military power, but in terms of non-nuclear weapons, it's impossible for North Korea to catch up with South Korea or the United States and Japan. So the cheapest way for North Korea to balance its military power against South Korea, the United States and Japan is through nuclear weapons and missiles.
North Korea's missile tests on Sunday followed U.S.-South Korea joint naval exercises off Okinawa, with the participation of a U.S. aircraft carrier and South Korean destroyers. South Korean intelligence and satellite imagery analysis now indicate North Korea may be ready for a nuclear test, its first since 2017. Even before his inauguration in May, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol had staked out a hardline position on North Korea, advocating for U.S. strategic nuclear assets, more missile defenses, and preemptive strike capabilities. The question is whether such policies will make South Korea and the region safer. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine war are entering a new stage, as Washington and its allies in Europe continue to send military equipment to Kiev. The U.S.'s new plan to send long-range missiles to Ukraine has sparked a stark warning from Russia.
If they supply Ukraine with long-range missiles, we will draw the appropriate conclusions and use our weapons, of which we have enough, to strike targets we haven't yet hit.
Putin said Moscow is destroying U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine by the dozen. He said Russia is easily coping and targeting the shipments. Putin said the sole aim of the West supplying arms to Ukraine was to prolong the conflict for as long as possible. His warning was echoed by the Russian foreign minister. Sergei Lavrov warned the supply of advanced missile systems to Ukraine raises the risk of a third country getting dragged into the conflict.
The things that the Kyiv regime unapologetically demands from its Western patrons, firstly, overstep all bounds of decency and diplomatic relations, and secondly, are a direct provocation aimed at drawing the West into combat.
On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden agreed to provide Ukraine with HIMARS multiple launch rocket systems as part of a $700 million weapons package.
The capabilities in this package include high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, and guided munitions with a range of up to 70 kilometers, 5 counter-artillery radars, 2 air surveillance radars, 1,000 additional javelins and 50 command launch units, 6,000 anti-armor weapons, 15,000 155-millimeter artillery rounds.
HIMARS is a mobile unit capable of simultaneously launching multiple precision-guided missiles up to 80 kilometers away. Since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Washington has approved 11 military assistance packages for Ukraine. The biggest was last month and worth $40 billion. European countries have also followed suit. Aside from that, the United States has provided intelligence that helped Ukrainians locate and strike Russian targets. But where does the line between supporting an ally and actively participating in the conflict lie? Many believe that gray zone is getting dangerously blurred. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah faces an environmental nuclear bomb. If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic? The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east, and just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns call the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now, two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake's surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses, and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area, checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake. Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and the grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boom town. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitah Wai. The U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, backed by Israel, submitted a draft resolution to the IAEA, citing Iran's incomplete cooperation in their eyes. And that seemed to have worked, and it was successful. The IAEA Board of Governors, with a vote that took place, has passed that resolution against Iran. Now, Iran has said it does not have anything to hide. Nevertheless, Western governments are accusing Iran of non-cooperation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look the ramifications of this resolution being passed against Iran, how that will influence the JCPOA revival talks, and whether this would derail the talks altogether. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, political commentator, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, who's an author and journalist, joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, first to you. So we've had the IAEA 35-nation Board of Governors passing the resolution, and just China and Russia actually vetoed it. Your reaction?
Hello, thanks for having me. Well, definitely this has been a hostile move, as somehow foreseen, and Tehran was in contact with the opposite sides in the nuclear deal, or nuclear talks, actually. And it has been sending messages in the last week, especially a message in the last 2 days, warning that, as usual, the path for diplomacy is open. Tehran is ready for continuing the talks as usual and within a specified timetable. But in case they go for adopting this resolution, then there will be a turbulent situation and tensions would escalate, definitely, and Tehran would reciprocate it. If you just remember, a couple of nights ago, I was on The Spotlight with you, I believe, and I said that Tehran is ready by every means to reciprocate any kind of hostile move by actions that will be twice more and twice tough. So, as you just witnessed today, Iran started its actions, reciprocal actions. Some believe that Iran would wait until the fate of this resolution would be clarified, and it would give it, an overall response to the IAEA chief Gerusi's mischiefs and the biased reporting to the Board of Governors that set the stage for the adoption of this resolution. Okay. And also the resolution and the Western governments. But as you just saw, Tehran is giving detailed answers. That was a reaction to the IAEA chief and IAEA itself that had been, ignorant of Iran's increasing cooperation, was removing number of cameras that had been installed on voluntary basis under the JCPOA, and while Iran's not receiving the merits of the JCPOA, so it removed the cameras and some other devices that had been installed and kept in there as a gesture of goodwill. The second move came a few hours later after Iran declared to the agency that it would go for mounting two cascades of its most effective and the best machines, IR-6, the sixth generation of machines, centrifuge machines, in response at Natanz, in response to the non-cooperative approach of the IAEA and the opposite sides. Now that the resolution has been adopted, we should wait for Iran's tough responses, as I had vowed a couple of nights ago. In the next 24 hours, Tehran has power components, and I believe Tehran's responses are in the offing in various areas, and we will know about them more tomorrow on Thursday, I believe, or by Thursday this time.
Okay, very well. Daniel Lazar, as our guest Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh mentioned there, he talked about two reactions that Iran has partaken in. One of them, disconnecting to the nuclear watchdog's monitoring cameras, of which it came out and it said that there's some ambiguity that is still being reported that some cameras were disconnected. There's two that were disconnected. That's confirmed. Now, Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh talks about the centrifuges, the IR-6 centrifuges, to now have been installed. That's what he is saying. It's probably accurate, but I can't confirm that because this development came in the past, I could say, about 10 minutes or 15 minutes. But if indeed that is true, which it very well may be, but, you know, we can't still come out and say that. However, those are the two reactions, of which there's more based on what Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh said. And I can tell you he's very well informed. So given all that's happened, including the resolution obviously this past, where do you think these talks are going to be going? What's your assessment on it?
Well, my assessment is it's very hard to say. They could drag out for a long time, or it's also possible that we're nearing a breaking point. I mean, one thing that's changing is that since the Ukraine war, the Europeans are much more subservient to the U.S., much less independent than they were before. So therefore, I think that Iran is finding that on the IAEA is on the whole much more hostile than it was previously. So Iran is up against the wall. It's pushing back. There are these small maneuvers are taking place. It's hard to say what the next step will be. But clearly the negotiations are not going well. They are not in a good place. But my attitude for the last few years has been one of great skepticism. I don't believe that the Biden administration is politically capable of entering into an agreement with Iran. I think the pressures on it from Israel, the pro-Israel lobby, the neocons, et cetera, are just too great for Joe Biden to buck. He will never give in. He will never drop the terrorism label, for example, from the Revolutionary Guards. That seems to be politically impossible here in the U.S. So I just can't see these negotiations as being ultimately fruitful. So yes, they may drag on for a long time. We may have these very intricate, very technical back and forths. But in the end, I think these talks are doomed.
Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, if we're looking at reactions, we already had two of them, one of them which is confirmed and one that which you have said. And again, no offense. I'm sure that's going to...
Let me correct it. I forgot to say that Reuters said that it has seen a part of the information that has been relayed to the IAEA that Iran has declared that it is going to install two cascades of centrifuge machines. I also have heard it from a different source, but, you know, I'm not an official, but That's one of the many moves that I expected since, two nights ago that I said Iran would reciprocate it. So I'm not sure if this has been declared by Iranians or not officially, but at least this is what Reuters has claimed. And I've heard it also from a different source. And it's widely expected, and you might be hearing about it if it's my words are accurate, then you will hear about it in half an hour.
So do you think that based on these two, one which we're going to get confirmation on, obviously, and the other which is confirmed about the cameras, you say that there's going to be other options that Iran is going to partake in, and it might be more severe? Again, this is why we're talking about this and why we have this program. What kind of options do you think Iran might partake in, given what has happened?
Well, Iran has power components, and the U.S. has long been going after the containment strategy through exercising the carrot and stick policy in order to contain these power components in various areas, including the nuclear industry, the missile industries, its regional power. It's nanotechnology, it's aerospace technology, it's laser technology, and many others. And I believe that Iranian responses would definitely come in the first three areas that I just mentioned, the nuclear and missile industries or its regional power. I believe it would be so open and so loud that everyone would hear about it, no doubt. These are not, for escalating the tensions. These are, let's remember that these are reciprocal moves. In other words, Iran is defending itself. Let me remind you that everything started last month. After 2 months of war of willpower between Iran and the United States, then Iran came up with a new initiative and called Mr. Mora to Tehran and informed him of the new initiative. When he was leaving Tehran, he was having a grim face, a happy face, actually. And then he informed his boss, Joseph Borrell, the foreign policy chief of the EU. And Borrell was immediately happy, and he said that there is new hope coming for working out a deal. But after a few hours, they both lost their hope, and they were sad again because they received the United States response, apparently very unexpected negative response, because the United States has started bullying. They imagined that they could ask more from Iran through exercising pressure. That's a worn-out tactic. We are very well acquainted with the U.S. negotiating strategies and tactics after two decades of bargaining and negotiations several times. So they started using leverages like media warfare, trying to provoke peaceful protests that are very, something normal in Iran as a democracy, into rioting. And then they tried, they used cyber attacks, and they used the Israeli terror machine for assassinations and sabotage attacks. They imposed new sanctions on IRGC and Iranian entities, and they also ordered Greece to seize Iranian crude cargo, which was reciprocated with the seizure of two ships, to send this clear message that enough is enough. You're doing this just as leverage, as part of the negotiations, to win more merits from Iran. Okay, we are going to reciprocate that with double more actions, tougher actions, in order to put an end to this kind of gaming that you have started. Let's do the negotiations, negotiations, real deal. So ever since then, Iran has been sending this message that if you try, you continue this kind of option and go for the IAEA resolution, then we know how to play the games. We are not
We're trying to understand over here the logic that's being used by the U.S. and the other countries that propose this draft resolution, which is now passed, Daniel Lazar. For example, let's take a look at one of the reactions, which is Iran disconnecting those two cameras. Well, the U.S. comes out and says it's really unfortunate that Iran has done that, because that shows that, we are losing cooperation by Iran. Well, then why would you propose a resolution to be passed, which has been passed, when it has consequences like this? I mean, if the intended goal is cooperation, then why move towards lessening the cooperation?
And why walk out of the agreement in the first place?
There you go.
As Donald Trump did in 2018. How does the U.S. get? Where does the U.S. get off accusing Iran?
And I'm sorry. I got to jump in here and tell you those cameras were operating as a goodwill gesture.
Yeah, yeah. Where does the U.S. get off accusing Iran of being uncooperative when it's the U.S. which has sabotaged the JCPOA? It makes no sense whatsoever. It's farcical. And these negotiations, which are dragging on for years, give no sign of making any progress at all, due entirely to spurious objections raised by the U.S., most especially concerning the status of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, which is not a topic that really has something to do with the JCPOA at all in the first place.
Indeed.
So the position of the U.S. is completely absurd. Yet allies are not objecting. The parties to the JCPOA are not objecting, except for France and China, Russia and China, of course. Instead, they are going along with this whole ridiculous procedure. I really know the parallels with Ukraine are striking. The U.S. pushed and pushed and completely ignored the possibility of a war actually breaking out. And guess what? A war then did break out. The U.S. is pursuing the same reckless course in the Persian Gulf. And I think it's very possible that one consequence will be the eruption of war in this theater as well. So the U.S. is essentially encouraging war in two, danger spots on the globe. This means world war, and the U.S. recklessness is just growing. This is absolutely astonishing.
But the fact that the resolution has been passed, there were question marks about whether this is going to go to the UN. What indications are there that it will or will not go at this point, given that the resolution has been passed, do you think?
First of all, IAEA resolutions, the Board of Governors resolutions, do not necessarily end up in a UN Security Council voting. There are different outcomes. As has been stated by the U.S. and the EU, they've been saying that they do not mean to refer the case. That was not actually the content of this resolution. The aim was just, as I said, a political circus show to increase the pressure on Iran. Actually, if they meant to refer the case to the UN Security Council voting, it would definitely be faced with the Chinese and the Russians vetoing. And that's exactly why I say it's a political show, because if they really meant action, they had an easier way, much shorter way, without any trouble. They didn't need any kind of IAEA resolution or anything else. They could activate the trigger mechanism, the Europeans, and then they would easily go to the UN Security Council voting that would be veto-proof, actually. So they never meant to just do action, but they just meant to stage a political show to force Iran to retreat in the Vienna talks. And as I said, this is the last in a chain of moves, hostile moves, all to pressure Iran, which are all of these moves are pretty well known to Iran. And that's why Iran is responding differently from the past. Let's remember that Iran tried appeasement strategy under Rouhani for 8 years. Then when Iranians received no merits under the deal, the JCPOA, and they complied with all their undertakings, then Iranians, people, realize that this is a wrong way, totally wrong way, because after 8 years of given wide access under the harshest regime of inspections ever imposed on any nation, they earned nothing. So they voted for the revolutionary government of President Raisi to change the strategy at home and abroad and go for reciprocal action for this for the policy of staging policy, muscle flexing, and reciprocal actions, tit for tat actions. And that's exactly what the Iranian Supreme Leader said and stressed several times, that the hit and run era is gone. You may not pressure Iran and escape unharmed. And so they start, they are gaming. This is part of the negotiation they're doing. This is leveraging Iran. Right. And Iran knows the game. It's leveraging them. Now, let's see who has more options available that has not yet been used. Who has more instruments and options and initiatives and power up his sleeves?
All right. So we need to talk about Israel here, Daniel Lazar, because obviously it looks like Israel did have a major role to play with this resolution being passed. Even before that, when the snap visit was made by the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel, the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett told him, we need to send a message to Iran. There needs to be a resolution passed in order for there to be a message to Iran. Talking as if this resolution was going to get passed already, and I understand it was a short visit. And it's really strange how this resolution being passed is not the breaking news in a few websites that are Israeli origin. It's not even there yet. I'm sure it's going to come. So do you think that this was a nod by Israel when Grossi visited after it pushed for this to be passed, which obviously was presented by the U.S. on the E3?
It's very hard. It's very hard. The answer is I don't know. I don't know exactly what the process was. I don't know whether the pressure came from Israel or Israel somehow contacted its allies in Washington to exert pressure. I really cannot answer that question. But all I can say is that it is, again, astonishing that Israel, which has more than 200 nuclear warheads and is not even a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, has the gall, the absolute cheek, the chutzpah, to criticize Iran's nuclear enrichment program. This is really astonishing.
Thank you for that. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Daniel Lazar, author and journalist from New York. Said Mostafa Khoshnesh, thank you so much. Political commentator from Tehran. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikovit Tahvei, it's goodbye until next time.